each of the panelists who will respond in turn. Our panelists today are Mayor Michelle Staples from City of Falcon. We have Mayor Ken Papa from the City of Chilliwack. We have Mayor Tom Dice from Kelowna. And we have Councillor Corey Ramsey from the City of Prince George. So welcome and thank you for participating. I want to ask a couple questions here for each of the panelists. We'll give you approximately 2 minutes to respond. I know some of these questions might take a bit more than that, but we'll see how we do. And the first question is how have encampments impacted your community, and how would the prospect of adequate shelter space in your community as a precondition to seeking decampment injunction after your approach to addressing encampments? And we'll start with Mayor Staples.
Thank you very much, and thanks for this opportunity to kind of speak about this challenge that we're facing in many communities. One of the questions that we started off when we had this conversation is how do we define what an encampment is? Because in different communities, it's going to look very different. In our communities, we may not have one large area of an encampment. We may have, and we do have, many smaller gatherings throughout our region. I represent a city that is in the center of a larger region. We're a city of 5,000, the smallest city in Canada, but we service close to 50,000 people, and everything sort of comes into the center. And so we face costs, social, economic costs, environmental costs. You know, we have a lot of camps that are being set up along the Couchin River in the Seminoles Marsh area. So there's a huge environmental cost to some of the places that the encampments are taking place. There's also the cleanup costs between our neighbors. So we neighbor with Couchin Tribes, with the Couchin Valley Regional District, and the municipality of North Couchin. We've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars addressing encampments. Sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars just for one, depending on where that encampment is and how long it has been. And then there's the social costs. There's huge social costs to this, particularly in a small town. If I'm in the city or on the mainland, there's a lot of areas where I can go where I may not see unhoused populations. In our communities, because everything is centralized, every single person who drives into town sees evidence of this everywhere they go. So it feels like a huge burden for a small region. And there is a lot of social implications with this, simply because the pressures that it puts on businesses, on residents, on concerns about safety, and there's no conversation we can have about solutions that does not come back to homelessness, whether it's affordable housing, even the BC Builds Code that we made today. Everything comes back to the conversation around how are you going to deal with homelessness and with the opioid crisis. And so after we had an encampment many years ago, a large one downtown, that is different from the ones that I've just been describing. And one of the things that we did to respond afterwards was to set up areas that people can stay overnight and then have to move in the morning in our camps, increase bylaw patrols. We now have a warming center. And these, when I say we, I'm speaking more, some of them are Duncan-centric and some of them are more of a region approach. And not letting encampments grow. And so bylaws are out there every single day, moving people.
Awesome. And we'll just keep working our way down the table here.
I ask you to just repeat the last part of that question once again. I think I heard it correctly.
Yeah, so how would the prospect of adequate shelter space in your community as a precondition to seeking decampment injunction affect your approach to addressing encampments?
Thank you. So encampments themselves are a result of where homelessness, toxic drugs, mental health gaps, housing and affordability all kind of come together. It's a crisis center for that. And as mentioned initially at the beginning, it is a combination of both provincial, and there was substantial comments about provincial, but I also believe that it's also federal that have put these into action, which now fall upon municipal governments. And when we're looking at what we do within our communities, for most of us, pretty well for all of us, one of the biggest concerns is safety. and safety, what is happening with respect to those individuals who are living at these sites, what is happening with regards to the crime that they're experiencing, the assaults that they're experiencing, or the cold weather if it hits them, the safety of the personnel, of the first responders within our communities. For our community, we have had 5 interactions with bylaw officers at these sites, and then also for the broader community, what is the safety that is being affected for our broader community, our neighborhood businesses, with the locations that these areas are in, how it's affecting those businesses with regards to theft and damage to those businesses. And for our communities, it has a significant financial impact. We are in the process right now of undergoing an analysis to see exactly what the impact is, not only with respect to the assets that we own within the community, but also our bylaw, our RCMP, and initial viewing on that is stating that it's in the millions of dollars. So that audit is being prepared to give us a true exact, but I do know that in our 2024 budget, we basically allotted for 16 new RCMP officers and 6 new bylaw officers and new firefighters also to deal with the effects of the drugs on the citizens, on those individuals who are affected within our community. We now have put in place 10 full-time bylaw officers dedicated to homelessness and have developed a new social development department staff. We currently have, at this point in time, 278 emergency shelter spaces, which is at a 93% occupancy, and we have about 250 individuals on our street. The concerning part with regards to the last part of the question was that there are a good number of those 250, regrettably, even if we're able to develop spaces for them to stay in under the criteria that is being looked at this point in time, there'd be nobody in there that would be able to work to make certain that they maintain that space, because a lot of our service providers are saying it can be a very unsafe environment for them with some of those individuals in there based upon the mental health addictions that they have, or also for the mental health or the drug addictions that they have. So there is a concern with regards to that we just, if there is encampments and removing them, even if we had those little spaces and they were obtained, whether or not we'd be able to manage the people who are in them due to their needs. Thank you. Thank you. Court.
Thanks, Corey Ramsey, Councillor for the City of Prince George. I'm perhaps going to split this into two parts. How have encampments impacted our community? Since 2021, much of our focus has been dedicated to encampments as a result of Chief Justice Hinkson's precedent setting decision on the City of Prince George's injunction request, citing that the city's application for a declaration that the respondents have contravened the zoning bylaw by using the encampments as campgrounds contrary to the permitted zoning is dismissed on the basis that absent other suitable housing and daytime facilities, the occupants of those encampments must be committed to stay at the encampment. Prior to and since this ruling, we have been continuously and diligently working on this file to make progress for all who reside in our community. I do not know how to convey to you how bad the situation is in Prince George. In my opinion, the epicenter of this crisis, other than to share the facts. A report called the 2021 Estimate of Homeless Population in British Columbia, published by the province of BC and BC Housing, found that Greater Vancouver was the census division in which the greatest number of individuals experiencing homelessness reside, but Fraser Fort George is a census subdivision with the highest level of homelessness per capita basis. The BC Coroner's report, deaths of individuals experiencing homelessness 2015 to 2022, identified that 8% of all homelessness-related deaths in the province of BC are from the Northern Health Authority, namely Prince George. The unregulated drug death summary from the BC Coroner's Service also identified that by Health Authority in 2023, the highest rates of unregulated drug deaths were in Northern Health, 67 deaths per 100,000 individuals 46 deaths per 100,000 individuals in 2023. We know that there are more individuals experiencing homelessness in Prince George at a far greater per capita rate than any other community in the province, and we also know that as a result, far more individuals per capita are dying from homelessness and unregulated drug deaths. As a municipality, despite housing and healthcare not falling under our jurisdiction, we are spending between $11 to $12 million per year on downtown homelessness, social, and prolific crime issues. Encampments are drastically impacting our community. The second part of that question, how would the prospect of adequate shelter space in your community as a precondition to seeking a decampment injunction affect your approach to addressing homeless encampments? This creates, I think Jeff really nailed it in his opening remarks, but this creates a really challenging barrier to communities, not just ours. Here's why. When you visit the BC Housing website, under their homelessness counts research heading, it says the following. In 2023, the province of British Columbia funded homeless counts in 20 communities. Homeless counts give important baseline information on the estimated number, key demographics, and service provision needs of people experiencing homelessness. A point in time count provides a snapshot of people who are experiencing homelessness in a 24-hour period. The province's point in time count, homeless counts, will help the province and communities understand who is experiencing homelessness and why, and the results inform the development of supports and services that will best help people in need of different communities. To first determine if we have adequate shelter space, we need to understand two things. How many people, not tents, not shelters, not buildings, how many individuals are experiencing homelessness? Number two, how many shelter beds are available by community, by shelter? By BC Housing's own admission, we don't know. We know in 20 communities. We need better data. We need the point in time counts and shelter data to be completed by BC Housing for all communities, and we need it to be transparent and publicly available. Additionally, we need to ensure that there is respect and consideration for municipalities and our obligation to public order and safety. If individuals have been provided multiple offers of housing but refused, we need to work together and ensure that information sharing is occurring so that a municipality has the ability to file an injunction. If we don't have access to the data, if the information sharing is not occurring, these encampments will be entrenched in our communities even more than they already are, and the vulnerable people who need the supports most will not get the help they need.
Awesome, thank you.
But we experience homelessness in all our communities, and you know, the premier said 10 days ago, encampments are not a safe place for these folks to live. I totally agree with that. In Chilliwack, it's a unique situation. We've had to get an injunction once, and this goes back about 2015-2016, through a redevelopment of our downtown, and we went through the process. It wasn't cheap, but it worked. We haven't had to use that strategy since. We try to move folks along into places where they can get help. We've created a wellness center that is open 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, that provides some food, a hot coffee, some wound care, and a place for these folks to just chill out and hang their hat. It's not unique to any community. Every community is different. We have almost 300 beds in our community through supportive housing units and through the private sector as well, and through BC Housing-led strategies, which we have to work in concert with. To have adequate beds takes a strong partnership, and I wish the minister was still here, because we've had a third supportive housing unit that has stalled. It's 2 years behind. Us as a city, we did a quick rezoning to get it done. We took the shots to the head from the public because this is not a good thing, but it is a good thing. So we are promised that that will open sometime in maybe late spring, early summer. That's another couple hundred folks that will receive some help. There's going to be a partnership with Fraser Health to add some complex care beds, which is something that we dearly, dearly need. This problem isn't unique to any community. We're all dealing with it in our own way. And I don't feel that one size is going to fit all. And you'll probably hear me say that a few times, because in Chilliwack, I feel we do a pretty good job of managing, but we still need the partnership with both Fraser Health and with BC Housing with all the issues that are in front of us.
Thank you. And I have a question too here for everybody. Does the province and BC Housing share data with your community regarding shelter availability? And does your community currently have enough shelter space available to the quality identified in the bill? And we'll start with Mayor Popo this time.
Short answer is no. We have on a social development side of our house, we take inventory of the beds available on a daily basis. We are in tune with our Salvation Armies, there's a place called Ruth and Naomi, and we get that pure data daily, so we can tell our outreach workers, our bylaw staff, where they may be able to go to get a roof over their head, and that's really what these folks need. And I'm a firm believer in the housing first strategy and with wraparound service, but no, BC Housing does not share that information with us. We do have a couple tables that we work with them on through Chilliwack Healthy Communities. There's over 50 service providers that sit at that table. We have situation tables that are working monthly. We have a housing task team that is usually between 20 and 30 folks that sit at the table, share information, talk about certain individuals that need more help than others. So it's a real team event to work on this issue that's before us. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm also going to say no, but I will be generous in that our CAO did let us know that last week BC Housing has started to send weekly updates to the Heart and Hearth team with shelter data. And while it's important progress, we still don't have point in time counts. So we can say like, oh, there's this much availability in the shelters, but how do we know what is enough when we don't know how many people are experiencing homelessness? If yes, so that's kind of a maybe. So if yes, does your community have enough shelter availability? Last September, we received shelter availability counts showing that there were over 20 shelter spaces available, which had been available for over 4 months. And that, to me, is a significant number of spaces. You know, we have people sleeping outside in minus 20 and minus 40 that are denying housing. So I do think that we perhaps need to just review our shelter systems. I don't know, I get questions often, when is the last time this housing provider was reviewed, because I don't want to go inside, I don't feel safe, or they're not meeting my needs. I think that there is perhaps a lot of work to be done on that front to understand the barriers that exist in the shelter system so that we can ensure that they're meeting the needs of the people that they're meant for.
This is a third no. BC Housing does not share the data with us, but there was, as was mentioned, there was a report that we did know was released last week, but we still do not have any of the data points on it. In Kelowna, what we looked at doing was we took an initiative to build and develop an online shelter capacity dashboard. It was a public online tool that quickly sees what availability is available at the shelters. It's coordinated with the bylaws and the RCMP and frontline staff so that if there is availability at the shelters, they're able to direct someone specifically towards those shelters. and the items are updated automatically. As I had mentioned, we do have 278 emergency shelter spaces. It's operating at 93% capacity. And we do have 250 individuals or thereabouts who still need those shelter spaces. So there is a substantial need for looking at increasing those on a variety of areas. It is why the Heart and Hearth has been a priority for us and advocating as much as possible. For that, we do have some new spaces which are opening up, which would, over the next little while, there's three stages of 60 which are going to open up, and the idea with respect to them would be that we would then take from the existing shelter spaces and move them into those locations, and then backfill the shelter spaces with the individuals who are on our streets. But again, it goes back to the concern that I had a little bit earlier from the shelter providers that that we hear is that there's concerns that not all of those individuals are individuals who are able to exist within those shelter providers because they put some of their staff at risk, or a number of those individuals have been asked not to come back to the shelters just with regards to their concerns around their activity. Thank you. Thank you. Mayor Staples.
So we'll have a fourth no. And again, I think hearing very much, we go through the same thing where we do have a lot of agencies working together, sharing information. Our bylaws is out every day. They're connecting with the other regions around us with their bylaws teams. And so there's a lot of internal communications between everyone to know what is available on a daily basis, to know who's out there, to know what's happening, and to share that information. We're also forming coordinated access, as I'm sure many people are, which I have some hopes for, but that information isn't shared with us in terms of the actual data. And in terms of housing counts that have come up, we did a housing count, and I believe it was 173, and we have housed people since then, but the last count that we had was closer to 200, with another 200 living precariously in different forms. And and further to that, there's the challenges around what those actual spaces available are. Our shelter spaces, we only have approximately 40 shelter spaces, like on an emergency basis. During the wintertime, we have an additional 20 that are only open on under certain weather conditions. And also under under this new legislation, looking at other case law, and Prince George, you've touched on some of the case law around what you've experienced, but just what the definition of actual shelter spaces is. There's Supreme Court findings that speak to the fact that the space must meet diverse needs of population. The spaces must be truly accessible. If the available spaces are impractical for homeless individuals, either because shelters do not accommodate couples, are unable to provide required services, impose rules that cannot be followed due to addictions, or cannot accommodate mental or physical disabilities, they are not low barrier and accessible to the individuals they're meant to serve. So when we're talking about spaces, what exactly are we talking about? And it's not something that is just every shelter space that's available, every organization that has shelters has different abilities to accommodate different people. As you mentioned, people with higher needs need different types of shelter space, and it needs to be predictable. Shelter space is not, in an emergency, sure, but we move far past that emergency, and that type of space is not predictable enough for people to either A, have access to it. What happens if you get a break in service and you have nowhere else to go? There are so many conditions that we're placing people in, and so we'll try to solve this. It seems like we're creating a bigger gap for more and more people.
Thank you, and we'll move on to the next question. And what does your community need from the provincial and federal governments to address homeless encampments? And we'll start with Mayor Staples, and we'll work back.
Thank you for that question. So I spoke a bit about coordinated access, and while I appreciate what coordinated access do, I think it's going to be an important tool for us to know, it's providing that all service providers are at the table together, making decisions and understanding who is up there working with BC Housing. What we really need is regional plans for housing, particularly in smaller communities. things that I mentioned is that we're at the core. So we have people, you know, from Lake Houchen, from Shawnigan, from the South End, from other parts of the region coming into the core because that's where the services are. And all of us could say that to a degree, right, that a lot of communities deal with the same thing. Now, there is homelessness still in those other areas. Please don't get me wrong. It's just different types of homelessness. And so what we need, we know that if we come up with a regional plan, we know exactly who's in our community, what we need for them, then we can present, and we've done this in our community before, present a plan to the province saying, here are all the people that are unhoused. Here's what 70% of them need to get off the street immediately. Here's the complexities of another 10%. Here's the, you know, even deeper complexities of this other 5%. And here's some anomalies, and here's some people that need to be dealt with by the criminal justice system. And so if we can come up with those plans, whether it's regionally or, you know, in larger areas, there's obviously a different application for something like that, but then present them what we need so that we can actually create the type of housing that's required.
I'm just moving from one salon A into this other area so that I can listen to the short-term rental. I know that that affects my community more than homelessness in the way that we're talking about at that last panel.
Thanks, Jenna. Just a wrap up here. I think the city of Parksville has a very rigorous balanced housing plan in place. We're hitting way above average here. In between the social housing, supportive housing, going through affordable rental, market rental, and then regular, as we call them, the plexus, the multi-high density units, we have a building boom going on. And so we have rental units that we're building constantly, and every piece of bare land in Parksville now is being developed. And so it's very vigorous of what we're doing, and we're encouraging. We have a very good relationship with the developers, and they've discovered Parksville, and we've discovered how to get the build out of them that is going to be beneficial to our people. But and so it's disappointing that the ministry has come back and they say for us to receive an exemption for a purpose-built vacation rental areas. They have suggested that we have to attain a rental vacancy rate of 3% to do that. And once we get up to 3%, okay, then they'll consider granting the exemptions. But in Parksville, as fast as we can build, they're taking axes before they're even into the rooftop stage. They're already booked out. The rental ones are already built. But the people that had to move away from Parksville, that there was not sufficient rental housing, are moving back. They're saying, thank you so much, but they're being taken as fast as they're going. So we are never going to get that 3%. So to use that as a parameter, as a basis to attain our exemption that we're looking for, it's like saying, okay, here's the rules you have to play by. You're going to have to hit the goalposts that we put on the baseball diamond. Well, that doesn't really make sense because that's probably not achievable. And so we feel that that's a little unfair. If they were to perhaps to have a look at the amount of rental accommodation that we have built in Parksville in the past, the amount of affordable rentals that are still affordable, and the amount that we have already in the books, I think would be a better basis to make a marketing decision on whether we can exempt these other areas that are so important to Parksville. So we'd just like them to play by rules that are fair, and not just trying to achieve something that may be good in someone else's area where they don't have enough rentals, and we get that. But we are already hitting every base on the way through to make sure that we have enough rental accommodation.
Thank you for that context. And Mayor Bloomfield, do you have anything further to add?
Yeah, just a couple of things. And touching on the 3% vacancy rate, I think if the community is over 3% vacancy rate, you might have bigger problems than short-term rentals. You know, looking at the historical vacancy rates, I can't think of a time when there was, you know, greater than 3% vacancy rate in Penticton. I think that you know, There's some takeaways from all of this. I think the takeaway for the hotel industry is they have to look at themselves and say, you know, why has short-term rental business been such a boom? It's because the public are demanding that kind of accommodation, and the hotel industry has not been providing it. So I think that there's a message there for the hotel industry to provide the accommodation that people are looking for. Certainly in Penticton, we have people that come and they want long-term, short-term rentals. They want a week or 2 weeks or even a month. The kids are in the hockey school. They're doing training for different sporting activities. They're in the Ironman training camp or something like that. So they take out, you know, they occupy short-term rentals by the weeks rather than days. And so we need to, satisfy that demand as well. And I think that, you know, we just need a gradual and balanced approach, you know, because, you know, we've gone from basically an unregulated, from a provincial standpoint, unregulated industry to now a very severely regulated industry in one swoop. And, you know, that could bring chaos. And we don't want chaos. We want a nice gradual transition where the hotel industry can provide the accommodation that people are looking for. At the same time, maybe the licensed operators, they grandfathered in so that as they gradually diminish, you know, as they gradually sell those investments, they return back to the housing stock and you have a more gradual transition.
Thank you for that. I'll go to Councillor Kirby-Young and then we'll open up for Q&A. So folks in the room, if you want to start making your way to the microphones, one or two, and those online, you can start to put your comments or your questions into the Slido platform and we'll alternate between the two. But Councillor Kirby-Young, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to just add maybe another dimension to the conversation because hotels was mentioned, and I have a bit of background in this area. I was the director of marketing for Destination Vancouver for a number of years. And my job that I gave up to get on council, sometimes I still wonder why. But I did, my full-time job, you know, I didn't work as many weekends and all those things. But I was actually VP for a hotel company. We owned about 40 properties. And I think it's really important to daylight this conversation how difficult it is to build a hotel these days. It's really challenging. It's like building rental housing. Because the economics are really tough. It's why we saw lots of strata built, because the long-term payoff and the financing that you need to get now, there are very few hoteliers with deeper pockets that can afford that longer-term payoff. And so we just heard from the earlier session about BC Builds and the fact that they're looking at intervention mechanisms to support delivering on rental housing and missing middle income, and hotel is a very similar parallel to that because of the longer-term pieces. So in Vancouver, we're looking at how do we actually flex our policies as well to have a healthy ecosystem and bring in more hotels because we have required our zoning has also been quite archaic or old-fashioned where you had to have a standalone hotel with certain zoning, with certain areas, had to be a commercial use. And so now we're like, can you have it in neighborhoods? Can it be mixed use? Can it be housing and hotel? Can it be some of the innovative new models you see like Sonder where they take a couple of floors in an office building? Do we want to allow the market depression with office and some of the increasing vacancy rates to have conversion? Will there be unintended consequences? But I think we have to recognize, as what I was talking about earlier with intersecting policies, it's difficult to build hotel too. So I don't think it's that, to the point earlier, it's a really good conversation to have, that the hotel community doesn't want to serve this. They're just trying to figure out how to get hotels built because they know, and if you talk to any of the tourism bodies, they want that product. People want to come and stay and they want to visit us. And so I just kind of wanted to add that perspective to the mix as well, that it's also a different customer for someone that's coming to stay with their kid for several weeks for a sports camp, or for somebody else that's a longer term stay. And we have different regulations, for example, in Vancouver for 30 days or more. We delineate that as a different customer. We have different regulations and bylaws for that than we do for short term rentals, which has to be less than 30 days.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting piece here around the intersection of how the hotel industry is evolving. It goes back to the specific tourist zoning component that we have in Parksville in that example, right? And where does that align with this current STR regulation? I do just want to reflect on some of the feedback that we got from the audience in terms of the supports that you would like to see, and I think we're also seeing some of the variability within the communities that we have here represented, everything from more independence for municipalities to requests for provincial inspectors. So we can see that there really is some tension here on what it is that different communities need, but definitely up front there is the enforcement piece that I think we've touched on. So I want to go to Mike One. Please introduce yourself, your name, the community that you come from, and your question.
Thank you. My name is John Allen. I'm the acting mayor of the Resort Municipality of Harris and Hot Springs. It has some similarities to Parksville, but not nearly as successful. My question to you, Mr. Mayor O'Brien, is why can't you just flip the zoning in that special area that you talk of, make it a commercial zoning, and make the residential use, which is used by the owner-occupiers, the accessory use? By doing so, you are no longer in a residential area, and the existing residential use by the owners who are operating the rental suites can continue indefinitely. Consider that as a strategy to avoid Bill 44. Thank you.
Great question, and there was various considerations to perhaps changing the zoning and so forth to make it so that it couldn't be turned into long-term rental housing. And then a well-informed colleague of mine called me up and said, it doesn't matter what you zone the property over on, the province trumps everything. Zoning does not matter. The province will trump over the paramountcy, and they'll trump over whatever will be put in place. It is a good idea, but it would be just another way of the province to say, well, it doesn't matter. So yeah, I just have to realize that we are, I like to say, the first level.
I'd just like to clarify my suggestion. My suggestion was that when you rezone it to commercial, that it doesn't go, those rental suites do not go into the long term. They stay in the short term as commercial rental units rather than reverting to long term only. Just for clarification. Thank you.
It's a good suggestion and something that might be worth looking into a little bit more. Thank you for that. Is it possible to pull up, do we have any questions online from the folks who are joining us online? I'm not seeing them on our screen here. We'll go to mic two while those get brought up. So the folks who are joining us online, we will come back to your questions in just a second, but we'll go to mic two. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Keith Tom, District of Beachland Deputy Mayor. I have one compliment, first of all, before I list two concerns. My one hats go off to the hotel industry for their incredible lobbying the government to shut down short-term rentals. That's my opinion. I find it interesting that the province had decided on 6 or 7 tourist centers. I forget what the exact number is. In Peachland, we thrive on tourism, and that concerns me. And the other concern is that initially it sounded like the District of Peachland was exempt because we were 10,000 or under. Currently, West Kelowna City Hall is 17 kilometers away from us. They're building a new one that'll be 13 kilometers away from us. So if you're in a small town of under 10,000, check the neighboring community, because if it's under 15 kilometers or City Hall away from you, then you are not exempt. So that's, I think, was my own. And my other concern is that if landlords had more rights, I think more short-term rentals would convert to long-term rentals. Most short-term rentals can look at their cost of living. One year they can raise their rate 8%, sometimes 4%, sometimes 10%. If it's a long-term rental, if I'm not mistaken, it's 2.5%, which doesn't even catch up to the cost of living. So rectify the long-term rentals, and then maybe some people in the short-term rental would go, yes, let's do that. That's my comment. I don't know whether you have any comments about my absurd comments, but there we go.
Thank you for sharing your perspective. Anybody want to pick up on either of those comments?
Yeah, I'd like to thank you. Is it Keith? Keith, yeah, I'd like to thank you for that, because that is a common theme that I've had from some of the short-term rental operators in Penticton. They absolutely refuse to go back to long-term rental. There needs to be more equity in the Residential Tenancy Act. The Residential Tenancy Act is an act that should be for the protection of both sides of the business transaction, the landlord and the tenant. And the investors that have short-term rentals, on for the large part, have very little desire to go back into long-term residential tenancy agreements until there's a change in the equity of that act.
So if you need to get away from Penticton, we have several short-term rentals, you can come and visit us.
Anybody else have any thoughts? Go ahead, Mayor Brown.
Yeah, and just a further comment to the last speaker. We have to be careful that if we make enforcement of the short-term rentals to owners, you will drive this economy underground. The only reason that these can be tracked is, of course, they're used in the two major platforms, and we know who they are. And there's other platforms that are out there, not quite as recognized. And the two major platforms are giving us the information we need to license these people and so forth. But if we make it too onerous, you're going to just drive it underground, and everybody's just going to agree that they're not renting to that couple from Saskatchewan, they're renting to their brother, or they're just the brother or sister-in-law from Saskatchewan visiting. And so it's going to go underground, and you're going to make it uncontrollable. So be careful, because there's many other underground economies that thrive on too much policy and regulation, and that's why they thrive.
Thank you for that. We're going to go to one of the questions that's on the screen from Mark Gisborne, EA director in Quebec. Mark mentions that their local mill just closed. We need more tourism dollars. Killing short-term rentals in the hopes of it becoming housing is short-sighted. Housing at all costs neglects the economy and the environment, which is something that we've heard here with the panelists here today. The question is, how do we promote balance? And I think that that's one of the tension points here in the conversation. We've heard a few examples or suggestions come forward, but do you have anything further in terms of how we really balance the various needs across the province? Go ahead, Mayor Blair.
I'd like to take that. Just for Mark's comments there, I see he's an area director in a regional district, and so that is actually exempt from these regulations. So unless they opt in, then he should be out. You know? But balance, you know, this is what we're here today. This is what we're saying today, is that we want balance. You know, we want balance. We recognize the needs of housing. You know, we're here for 2 days to explore all the avenues of how to increase housing stock. I'm not convinced that this act is going to increase the housing stock by as much as people seem to think. I could be wrong. And I hope I am wrong, but I just don't see that this is going to have that effect. I think that we have to be more affirmative in what we do to create that affordable housing. We have the ability to do it, and we now have the backing of the provincial government and hopefully the federal government in creating that housing. So I think it's on us to create that affordable housing rather than to force it out of the short-term rental market. But balance comes not only in the regulations, but also at the time that it takes to implement the changes to the regulations. That's the balance.
Thank you. Councilor Caribbean?
I'll go back to sort of the stat I shared earlier. I think we still have, if you look it up now, 5,268 short-term rentals. Showing in the city of Vancouver, probably around a 3-to-1 ratio of the number of hotel rooms we have, 4-to-1 if you look at, you know, broader greater Vancouver. And in the 6 years with that big COVID piece in the middle, since our tourism sector has continued to grow, right? Record arrivals through Vancouver Airport, hotel occupancy going through the roof, economic impact, number of jobs. I think it really bears repeating how important tourism is. It's a really important part of the conversation. It's kind of, I say, the unsung hero. It actually delivers more GDP than the resource industries do in the province. I don't think it gets that credit. But our tourism did die because we started regulating short-term rentals. Very fair question to say, do we have the right balance? And now we have pressures on both. But, you know, I kind of go back to, and I really agree with the earlier person's comment around people don't want to rent it out now with the Residential Tenancy Act, that balance seems to feel like it's off for people because I get a problem tenant. I'm stuck there, or you know, I can only put my costs up 2.5%. Inflation was at 4, 5, 6, 7. So, you know, human nature, would you have an investment if your costs were going up much quicker than you could recover them? No, you wouldn't. But same thing with needing to address that, needing to look at how to make it easier to build hotels. I do think short-term regulation is important. I think it's a question around the how and the balance there.
Thank you for that. I'm going to go to Mike one. Go ahead.
So I'm Harrison, town of Colton Beach. So we're wrapped in the legislation because we're next door to Parksville. Thanks for that, Parksville. And I just want to point to one project in our community, which had 255 sort of small homes that were supposed to be part of a rental pool, based on models from Premier and Whistler. It's the exact same zoning, essentially, as Premier and Whistler, which are resort municipalities. We are not a resort municipality, so we don't have any flexibility. So one, it's a little bit frustrating that the province doesn't allow people to essentially opt in to a resort, essentially, not a resort municipality proper, but something similar. But also two of my fears, I'm looking at AirDNA, the website which actually tracks VRBO and Airbnb to a certain extent. And our pattern of distribution is principally along waterfront properties that are not going to become affordable rentals no matter what, as I was made in the ticket in, and our downtown, and one small suburban area. And my fear is with the principal residence requirement, we're going to see a shift into our suburbs of Airbnb activity because it meets that principal residence requirement, and then it actually makes it hard to build rental suites. As you're going to be looking at, well, if I'm going to a rental suite, this is where we do Airbnb now, unless the municipality explicitly forbids it. I'm just wondering, this is going to result in a curtailment. Sorry, those are just two points I was actually really bring for my committee, but the question is, have you guys reached out to the Chamber of Commerce about the decline in Airbnbs and short-term rentals? What will it mean for small businesses in your communities if you're a tourism domestic community? Thanks.
That's a great question. Anybody have any insights from their Chamber of Commerce and or their tourism branch?
Yeah, in Penticton we had a letter of support from the Chamber of Commerce supporting the city's position on this.
And I just can't comment on Scott's comment about the just driving into the suburbs, which is a very real possibility. So instead of those people in the suburbs putting in a basement suite for long term, then they're going to instead put in a short term, in the principal residence, put in a short term rental instead, a suite that is not a basement suite for long term. So you quite basically going to drive that out into the suburbs. And many of us have put legislation bylaws in place anyways to allow basement suites in virtually anywhere there's, you know, the SFDs are. And so by doing that, now if we're driving out there, it's going to just lessen the amount of what we're trying to do in between our carriage home and basement suite policies to encourage affordable rental. And you could very well do, as Councillor Harrison has pointed out, so is one more caution that we have to throw out to the province.
Yeah, that's from a District of Squamish perspective, we definitely have a mixed opinion on our chamber board because we hear in the same breath how difficult retention and recruitment of staff is, that they don't have somewhere for them to live long term. And at the same time, it is, as Councillor Kirby mentioned, extremely expensive, near impossible to build hotels in Squamish given the pro forma set and the capital that you need. And so it is a really important component to our tourism accommodation sector.
Can I jump in on that?
Yeah,
it's, I think to the comment around we should just build more hotels, it's really difficult. And don't forget that STRs are not paying commercial taxes, right? They're paying residential taxes. They might be paying the MRDT. That's going into supporting tourism marketing, right? So that supports that engine. But they're not paying the 2.8 times or whatever rate you have in your municipality of commercial taxes. They don't have a long payoff, they don't have a large capitalization. So I do think we have to be a bit thoughtful around what it actually takes to build a brand new hotel property today.
Yeah, that's helpful. I was just gonna add that one thing that we've done this year is we've actually, Tourism Squamish has worked with our Affordable Housing Society, and all of the MRDT that's coming from the online platforms is being delivered directly to the Affordable Housing Society in order to try and make that clear connection in terms of supporting affordable housing through the short-term rental market. I'm going to go to one of the questions online and then to mic number two. So the question is, from Jared Castle from the District of Lake Country, Director of Planning and Development. In your opinion, how effective would using strata hotels be in allowing STRs? So I think this adds in a little bit to your comments, Councillor Kirby-Young, if you have any thoughts, and then I'll go to Mayor Boutreau.
Yeah, it's tough. This is an online question to ask for clarification a little bit, but I think the question is, what is, how do you define a strata hotel, right? If it's something that somebody has a vacation ownership piece in it, which I think is what I'm interpreting the question as. I think that that's already part of the, if I can call it, tourism accommodation mix today. And so they effectively already attract a guest that wants that type of more of an apartment style feel, often cases where you typically, instead of a hotel bedroom, where you just get the bedroom and bathroom, you use other amenities in the hotel, these tend to have kitchenettes, right? Maybe it's ski resorts and other places where you've got a family and people, you know, want that type of accommodation. So I think that's already in the mix. I don't think that that's a game changer.
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting question because I'm actually having conversations with developers right now about strata hotel development, and in the regulations that we've been given, the provincial governor said that strata hotels are fine. You can have short-term rentals in strata hotels, provided that within the strata bylaws they don't allow them to be used for a principal residence. Which I kind of find, I find that kind of mind-boggling when we're talking about increasing the housing stock, and that yet they don't want to see principal residence use in a strata hotel. And the other part to that is that what that does, if that rule is in there, then that changes the financing requirements and the financing costs of anybody buying a short-term rental unit in a strata hotel. It really changes the dynamic and makes it a far less attractive proposition, because instead of going from residential financing, you go over to commercial financing. And that's a different cost. And so if there's one thing that would ever come out of this, if they took that requirement out of the short-term, out of the strata hotel section in the regulations, that would be a really big win, I think, and that would create a far, far better viability for strata hotels, because I've seen them built, I've seen them fail, I've seen them succeed. I've got 30 years experience in real estate and in the Okanagan, and I've seen all aspects of strata hotels, and I can tell you that if you've got that requirement in there, it makes them far, far harder to succeed.
Mayor O'Brien,
did
you have anything to add?
I think Julie has already answered it, but it was just if the question was around as well fractional ownership within these hotels and so forth. The province has advised that fractional ownership does not is not falling under the SCR legislation, so they are exempt. Actually, just for if the question was regarding fractionals, they're already exempt. So.
That's helpful clarification. Thank you.
And also, those fractionals are typically, I think, a lot of them already in resort destinations. The hotel company I worked for ran one in Sun Peaks. The owners had us as a hotel management company to do that for when owners didn't want to use it. And the occupancy was phenomenal, right, all the time. There were not rooms left waiting. It wasn't a particularly modern or the latest property in terms of amenities, and it commanded great rates, and it was always full.
We'll go to Mike, too. I really enjoyed this conversation. So my name is Sarah Fowler. I'm from the Village of Tassis. My community has zero functional hotels, so STR is the only thing that we have. When this legislation for STRs came into play, I got a message from someone who owns four properties, four houses, and rents them out STR from the beaches of Dominican Republic. That's where she messaged me from. But the point that I'm trying to make by telling this little story about my town is that this person is fixing up derelict properties, and when she said, oh, you're under 10,000, you can opt out, I said, that'll just leave us farther behind. So in short of giving her the advice of living for 3 months in each of her four properties, I'm wondering if you could give me some advice for my resident. Thank you. great Sarah Calipari that you come back in terms of advice for what in particular?
Well, for the, we are essentially a resort municipality that is not official. We have a boom town in the summertime when people come to the island to fish. When I first moved there, there was many empty houses that people just came for 2 weeks, but that was their summer home. And in the time since COVID, we've seen some of those empty homes fill out. We also have seen some burn or some fall down. So there's quite the range, but the sort of advice is, or the advice that I'm seeking, I see how Village of Tassis has a benefit to have some rooms available for seasonal people to come on vacation. And the sort of my resident is looking for a way to continually expand and make more beds available for people to rent. But under this new STR legislation, unless it's a permanent, unless it's a primary residence, then she can't. So I think that you kind of touched on some of it with the functional ownership or sharing, and or maybe like a person whose job it is to stay there and clean the place, and they get to rent as like a permanent person. So there's one basement dwelling that is for the maintenance crew, and then the nicer places upstairs for the more short-term accommodations. Does that help?
Yeah, wondering if anybody has any thoughts. I think one of the things might be to really reflect on whether you do want to opt in or opt out as a small municipality for these short-term rental regulations and their applicability. But does anybody else have any thoughts on the situation in Tassis?
I've had lots of people come up and talk to me about this and on both sides of the fence. And, you know, this is what we get paid the big bucks for, to make those tough decisions, because we make decisions based on the well-being of the community as a whole. And I tell people I cannot make a decision based on what's good just for you. I have to make a good decision on what's based on what's good for the community as a whole and the long-term vision of the community. So, yeah, you're going to upset some people. This legislation upsets some people. Our position on it is going to upset some people in the community, but you just have to convince them that you've got the community's best interests at heart.
Thanks for those wise words. I hear you make big bucks in Penticton, so I think I need to move communities. I'm just going to go, we're running out short on time, so I'm going to go to one more question online and then I'll come to mic number one. And I think this next question helps get to some of the heart of some of the challenges that we're seeing. So from Evan Peterill from the Director of North Coast Regional District, our construction sector can't build affordable homes if they are busy making more money building unaffordable short-term rentals, largely in affluent communities. It might be painful, but won't a bunch of exceptions undermine the intent of this legislation? Any thoughts on that?
I'll jump in on this one. I think I'm not sure that I draw the same distinction as I think Evan posed his question, because its construction costs are high now. There might be some differences in finishes, et cetera, but the cost of land is equivalent. Construction and labor has gone up consistently. The financing to deliver that, and theoretically you're in the construction sector, your job is to deliver a building to completion, and sort of regardless of the tenure. So is it harder to build rental versus condo, for example? Sure, because the payoff is longer, but construction is providing a service. They're not the developer, they're not the owner, typically the holder of the land. So I don't see that being a distinction in terms of building a short-term rental versus another project, unless there's much more in the finishings and the other pieces of the contract. There, the construction sector is just providing a service and they're in high demand, and they're going to build. So to me, that's not the challenge. I think it's more with the developers, the owners of the land, in terms of who's willing to build what kind of building and how, what that payback is, what the cost is to them to build and what the payback term is, based on the tenure of the building that they are delivering.
Yeah, thank you for that. Any other thoughts on this one?
Just my thoughts was, if we just let one panelist answer for each question, you might get through the rest of the questions.
Fair enough. We'll try and do it
question. I'm Elena Cody.